Who was responsible for shooting down the airplane carrying the presidents of Burundi and Rwanda 20 years ago, which triggered the Rwandan genocide? Did the U.S. and other Western countries bear responsibility for the mass atrocities in the West African country that left hundreds of thousands dead? How did conditional and aid guarantees from Western countries and the Bretton Woods institutions contribute to the humanitarian disaster? Are NGOs and human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch actually guilty of hiding the truth about the genocide? And what does the messaging around Rwanda tell us about Western attitudes toward Africans in general? On a week marking the 20th anniversary of the start of the Rwandan genocide, the Global Research News Hour hears from two analysts who present dissident views about what caused the bloodshed. Global Research founder and editor Michelle Chosudovsky, and the author of a provocative new book about the subject, Robin Philpott. On today's program, Rethinking the Rwandan Tragedy, conversations with Michelle Chosudovsky and Robin Philpott. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 11th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The declared goal now of the U.S., Saudi, Qatari, and Turkish financial, military, and logistical support for the insurgents is no more the regime change, but creating a balance of power aimed at improving their standing in future negotiations with the regime. To do so, they claim they are extending their support to what they describe as the moderate insurgents. However, moderate rebels are a rare species in Syrian insurgency. Entering its fourth year now, the war in Syria has created a highly polarized war zone that has left no room for any moderates. The fighting lines are strictly drawn between homeland defense and foreign intervention, between national forces and international terrorists, and between an existing secular and civil state and a future state perceived to be governed by an extremist or, at the best, a moderate version of Islamist ideology supported by the most backward, tribal, and undemocratic regional states with similar sectarian ideologies. That's from the article, "The War on Syria Has Taken a U-Turn. Assad Is There to Stay," by Nicola Nasser, posted April 9th. A Security and Exchange Commission prosecuting attorney, James Kidney, used the occasion of his retirement to reveal that higher-ups had squelched his prosecutions of Goldman Sachs and other banks too big to fail because his SEC bosses were not focused on justice, but, quote, on getting high-paying jobs after their government service, unquote, by protecting the banks from prosecution for their illegal actions. The U.S. Agency for International Development has been caught trying to use social media to overthrow the government of Cuba. This audacious recklessness comes on top of Washington's overthrow of the Ukrainian government, the NSA spying scandal, Seymour Hersh's investigative report that the sarin gas attack in Syria was a false flag event arranged by NATO member Turkey in order to justify a U.S. military attack on Syria, Washington's forcing down Bolivian President Evo Morales' presidential plane to be searched, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, the misuse of the Libyan no-fly resolution for military attack, and on and on. Essentially, Washington has so badly damaged other countries' confidence in the judgment and integrity of the U.S. government that the world has lost its belief in U.S. leadership. Washington is reduced to threats and bribes and increasingly presents as a bully. That's from the article, War and the Demise of the U.S. Dollar? Is the U.S. or the world coming to an end? It will be one or the other, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted April 10th. The White House and State Department have engaged in brazen lying to EU governments regarding the ability of the U.S. to supply more than enough natural gas to replace Russian gas deliveries. The dramatic rise in U.S. natural gas production from fracking or forcing gas out of shale rock formations is being abandoned by the largest energy companies like Shell and BP as uneconomical. The second problem with the U.S. offer of gas to the EU to replace Russian gas is the fact that it requires massive, costly infrastructure in the form of construction of new liquefied natural gas terminals that can handle the huge LNG supertankers to bring it to similar huge LNG terminal harbors in the EU. The EU gets some 30% of its gas, the fastest growing energy source there, from Russia today. In short, the chimera of shutting Russian gas and turning on U.S. gas instead is economic, energy, and political nonsense. That's from the article, Replacing Russian Gas Deliveries with U.S. Shale Gas? Washington Lies to the EU, by F. William Engdahl, posted April 10th. What would happen to nuclear power plants worldwide if their power and most of the surrounding modern infrastructure is knocked out? Nuclear power companies are notoriously cheap in trying to cut costs. If they are failing to harden their electrical components to protect against the predicted solar storm, they are asking for trouble, perhaps on a scale that dwarfs Fukushima. Because while Fukushima is the first nuclear accident to involve multiple reactors within the same complex, a large solar storm could cause accidents at multiple complexes in numerous countries. A large solar storm which knocks out electrical grids over wide portions of the planet will happen at some point in the future. The nuclear power industry is on notice that it must spend the relatively small amounts of money necessary to prevent a widespread meltdown from the loss of power due to a solar storm. That's from the article, An Inexpensive Fix to Prevent Armageddon. Or focus on overblown dangers and ignore the thing most likely to actually get us. By Washington's blog, posted April 9th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Michelle Chosadovsky is an award-winning author, professor of economics, emeritus at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. He's also the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order. Michelle Chosadovsky has devoted an entire chapter of his book, The Globalization of Poverty, on the economic genocide in Rwanda. He was also one of two economists who did field research in 1996 in the wake of the Rwandan genocide to determine the role of the Bretton Woods institutions and Western governments and aid projects in terms of their impacts on the Rwandan tragedy. So, Michelle, thank you very much for joining us.
Delighted to be on the program.
Okay, so you clearly are among the people who dissent from the traditional narrative of the Rwandan genocide, and you do place the blame squarely on the U.S. and in terms of its role in effectively displacing other players. I think we need to have some sort of a historical context for the genocide, you know, of 1994. I'm wondering if just like the nature of the Rwandan society and the role of outside actors in the lead up to say 1990 or so, and then through those years to the to 1994.
Well, there's a very long history. I could start in 1990, which is, of course, a landmark date because that was the onslaught of the so-called civil war. But in effect, what happened in September 1990 was an invasion by the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was largely composed of regular armed forces of the Ugandan armed forces. In other words, it was a detachment of the Ugandan military. They changed the labels and they initiated a liberating army, largely composed of Tutsis. This started in September 1990. It was subsequently led by Paul Kagame, who then, in a later period, became vice president and subsequently president, and he is currently the president of Rwanda. Now, Paul Kagame, prior to leading RPF forces into Rwanda, went to Fort Leavenworth Military Academy. In other words, he was trained by the U.S. military. There's ample evidence to the fact that the RPF was funded directly or indirectly by the United States. In fact, it was also funded by the World Bank because a large amount of credit, which were channeled to Uganda in the years preceding the invasion, were allocated to building up the military. And in effect, the military of Uganda was what allowed the creation of the RPF, so that Washington funds Uganda, Uganda funds its armed forces, diverting funds away from social programs, and the Ugandan armed forces ultimately then creates a contingent which constitutes the RPF, and that is the invading army into Rwanda. Now, at the same time, in September 1990, the IMF and the World Bank impose on Rwanda a devastating set of macroeconomic reforms. And the irony is that these reforms were implemented at the very outset of the invasion, leading to a situation of impoverishment of large sectors of the population, rise in consumer prices, farmers are driven into bankruptcy as a result, as a result of two related processes. On the one hand, the price of coffee tumbles on the world market from about $2.50 down to $1, leading coffee producers in a situation of near bankruptcy, and immediately the government actually freezes the farm gate price at a very low level, so that Rwandan farmers are in a situation where they can no longer cover their costs in terms of coffee exports. The costs of major inputs goes up, fertilizer, and so on and so forth. And at the same time, there's another important occurrence, which has to do with implementation of the IMF World Bank reforms. It's the lifting of trade barriers in terms of basic food staples, grain production. Rwanda was self-sufficient in grain, in food. It was actually exporting part of its production to neighboring countries. It was a very vibrant agrarian economy. Now, what happened in 1990 was, on the one hand, you see the increase in interest rates, and then you see also the increase in agricultural inputs. But what was also crucial there was that the World Bank imposed taxes on fuel, which virtually led to the virtually paralyzed internal trade. The fuel prices were so high that transportation within the domestic market became virtually impossible. And that, of course, affected the agricultural producers and the commodities they brought to market. And concurrently with that, the IMF World Bank imposed the deregulation of the grain market and the lifting of trade barriers, which meant the dumping of grain surpluses from the European Union and the United States on the domestic market, thereby literally destroying the peasant economy. So there you have a country which is largely based on agriculture. And the two sectors of that economy were food production for the domestic market and coffee for the export market. Both those sectors were destabilized.
So these moves, were they deliberate efforts to shatter the Rwandan economy, or were they just like missteps based on ideology?
Well, I would say it's a combination of both, because there is an ideology of free trade within the Bretton Woods institutions, but in effect, the people who implemented these reforms understood that this would destabilize the Rwandan economy. I don't believe that there was any mismanagement on the part of the IMF and the World Bank. The ideology of the World Bank and the IMF leads to destructive results. And the problem is that those officials who are working for these organizations, they are in effect committed to a certain ideology, and they don't necessarily see these implications. But in effect, the ultimate result was the destruction and destabilization of that economy at a time of conflict. Okay, the country was invaded. They were fighting. There was a confrontation between the regular armed forces of Rwanda under President Habyarimana, and then these invading forces, the Rwandan Patriotic Front. This also then led to ethnic tensions between the Tutsis and the Hutus, the two major ethnic groups in Rwanda. Now, I should mention that these two.
Yes. What's behind the? What's behind that that rivalry between the Hutus and the Tutsis? Was that always in existence, or was it somehow manipulated historically?
Well, the rivalry between Tutsis and Hutus goes back to the Belgian colonial period. There's a long there's a big debate and there's a long history. But during the Belgian colonial period, starting in the 1920s, people were defined by the colonial administration as the belonging to one or other of these ethnic castes or ethnic groups. The Tutsis were the owners of cattle, and the Hutus were farmers. The Tutsis were considered to be more, you know, to be on the whole...
aristocratic?
More aristocratic, but in effect they became aristocratic through their alliance with the Belgian colonial administrators. And the policy of the Belgian colonial government was to was essentially to use the Tutsis as a means of indirect rule, and they also they were also given privileges with regard to education and so on, and they had more social mobility than the Hutus, and in effect these two ethnic groups are in fact the same. They are, you know, that the division was created during the colonial period. It is the result of the colonial period, and but it subsequently became entrenched, and this led to conflicts, but those conflicts were nurtured from outside. And when the United States and Britain intervened on the side of the RPF, it fermented the conflicts between Hutus and Tutsis, and the invasion by the Rwandan Patriotic Front was part of a broad agenda to essentially establish an American colonial presence in Central Africa, in an area which was very strategic. It's the Great Lakes. It's contingent to the Congo, which is an area of tremendous mineral wealth. But it was also an intrusion into Francophone Africa. Rwanda was a Francophone country, although it was not, it had not been a French colony. France had tremendous influence in that region, in both Burundi and Rwanda, and the ultimate objective was to displace France, which was supporting the government, the Hutu government of President Habyarimana.
Okay.
And there's ample evidence to that effect.
So what about France then? I mean, they are being displaced. Is this something that was mutually beneficial, or was there, is there any indications of resistance from French quarters?
Well, you know, the problem is that the French do not, they're amply aware, at least the French government at the time was President Balladur, they're amply aware of the fact that, there were manipulations on the part of the United States at that time, and that they were being shoved out.
Professor Chossudovsky, it does seem as if the United States, if that was the plan, if you're correct in your assertions that they've largely succeeded, and the U.S. has largely succeeded in establishing a foothold in Uganda and Rwanda. What are we seeing now? This extending out to Congo and other countries.
Well, first of all, let me put this in context, because today France is being accused of having supported the government of Habyarimana, and in fact, tacitly They're also accusing France of having supported the genocide. There's ample evidence of the fact that the United States bears responsibility in triggering the massacres. Some of those massacres were perpetrated by the invading forces of the RPF, and that is known. But secondly, there's one incident which is very important, which is the downing of the shooting down of the plane with Habyarimana and the president of Burundi. And it is now documented that, of course, that plane was shot down on the orders of Kagame, and Kagame was acting on behalf of the United States. It also involves Louise Arbour, who at the time was prosecutor. I'm talking about who, after the genocide became prosecutor of the Rwanda War Crimes Tribunal, and that information has been, in a sense, has been removed from any kind of public review. I won't get into that, but I should mention that there was a covert operation to trigger ethnic violence. There was a plan to finance military forces to go into the country. Kagame was acting on behalf of the United States. The genocide was funded on the Ugandan side. And today, and this was acknowledged even by representatives of the French government at the time, where they actually intimated. They actually intimated that there was a conflict between the United States on the one hand and France on the other. These issues are extremely important. The Rwandan genocide served, in fact, strictly served geopolitical objectives. The country, in the aftermath of the genocide, moved from being a predominantly French-speaking African country to that of an English-speaking country. And in fact, in recent developments, French has been eliminated as an official language and is no longer taught at the secondary school level. At the time, the French government revealed that France was on one side and the Americans were on the other. They were arming the Ugandans, who were arming the Tutsis. And what the French government described, and I'm quoting Cooperation Minister Bernard Debré, "I don't want to portray a showdown between the French and the Anglo-Saxons, but the truth must be told."
Okay. Well, Michel Chossidowski, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for coming on our show and for your ongoing work with the Center for Research on Globalization. Plenty of articles on Rwanda over the past week and previous weeks. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we've been speaking with Michel Chossidowski, who's the editor of the globalresearch.ca website and professor of economics emeritus at the University of Ottawa. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, heard Fridays at 1 p.m. Central Time on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and aired on community radio stations across the continent. We would like to welcome radio station WZBC 90.3 in Boston, which occasionally airs the program Sunday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern Time during Truth and Justice Radio. The show is also regularly podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We're now joined by Montreal-based writer, translator, and publisher Robin Philpott. Mr. Philpott is the author of the recently released book, Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. Welcome, Robin Philpott.
Well, thank you for calling.
Mr. Philpott, in your book, you outline a dramatically different narrative of the Rwandan genocide. You place the blame for the mass atrocities principally on the U.S. and the Rwandan Popular Front, if I'm not mistaken?
The Rwandan Patriotic Front.
Patriotic Front, excuse me.
Exactly. And the U.K. As well. I guess where to start is, just to tell you about this book, my starting point in the way I make my case was a declaration that Boutros Ghali made, and he was the Secretary General of UN through that period, through the 90s, up until late 95, 96. And Boutros Ghali had said, and I found it in a footnote, and then I went and interviewed him on two occasions about it, but he said, the Rwandan genocide is 100% American responsibility. Now, this just went against the commonly held view or the narrative about what happened. So I managed to interview him, and I got him to explain what he meant. And he pointed out that in 1994, when war had started up again after the shooting down of the plane carrying two African heads of state, which is never seen before, is you have two heads of state assassinated at the same time, and nobody has bothered to find out who did it. But I'll get back to that. There were debates in the UN and the Security Council, and he said that any attempts to send in troops, or any will to send in troops to implement the peace agreement, because there was a peace agreement that had been signed in 1993, and it was in effect until the plane was shot down and the war was resumed. And he said any attempts by different countries, African, European countries, including France, to send in troops to ensure, basically to obtain a ceasefire and to apply the ceasefire and to apply the power-sharing agreement that was part of the agreement, the accords of the peace accord, were stymied by the United States and the UK. And they did everything they could to prevent the UN from sending in troops, from answering the call that Romuald Dallaire says he was making. And so, why were they doing that? That's the question. Why was the United States doing it? It wasn't the international community. It was the United States and the UK. The answer there is that they had sponsored a peace accord that came to a peace agreement signed in August 1993. That peace agreement was held until the shooting down of the plane and the immediate resumption of war. In fact, as it started, the troops had started moving before the plane came down, which showed that the RPF knew that the assassination was going to happen. But basically, they knew they were going to do it. And the United States had decided they abandoned the peace agreement and said we're going to pull for this side. And this, in other words, they decided we want the RPF to win and have a decisive victory. We don't want power sharing. The strategic interest of the United States there and the UK is domination of that part of Central Africa. And the only way that could happen was not to have a power sharing agreement. So what they did, they themselves scuttled the peace agreement and they chose to back the RPF at whatever the cost. Now, What about the killings, you might ask? And everybody knows that there were massive killings. But the only people in Rwanda who could have stopped that kind of killing were the army and the gendarmes and the political leaders. But they could not do so because they were engaged in a war to the finish with a very powerful military machine, the RPF, that was backed, armed, and diplomatically, politically, and militarily by the United States and the UK. I try and explain in my book the nature of the war that began in 1990, a bloody, destructive war that began in 1990 when the Ugandan army, branches of entire regiments of the Ugandan army, invaded Rwanda in 1990. Nobody talks about that.
And it was, that's like back in 1990, these incursions from the RPF, it resulted in numerous refugees. I don't know if there was
a stated... It was not incursions. It was an invasion. There were 4,000 uniform-bearing troops, members of the Ugandan army, who invaded in October 1st, 1990.
The Rwandan army?
No, the Ugandan army invaded Rwanda on October 1st, 1990, and they conducted a war. They occupied part of the territory, and they conducted. Then they occupied part of the land, and they kept conducting this war. They kept advancing. Then they'd have they'd advance. They engaged Rwanda in this prolonged war that became guerrilla war. It became terrorist acts within Rwanda, in Kigali, and controlled and activated by the RPF. The RPF had 146 clandestine cells in Kigali alone.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in 1993, I think.
Okay.
So they destabilized that country, and at the same time, you had the IMF, World Bank, closing in on the Rwandan government, and you had human rights groups coming in, basically trying to discredit the government in Rwanda, but not even looking at what the RPF was doing.
Okay. Robin, could we talk about the assassinations, because the shooting down of the plane in 1994, which sparked this increase of violence? And it seems as if you have alleged that Paul Kagame and the RPF were behind that, but I'm also hearing from there was a French probe back in 2012 which supposedly exonerated Kagame and his allies. Do you want to address that?
Yeah, the French probe began around 2000, or even before that. The reason being that the crew on the plane carrying President Habyarimana and President Ntaryamira of Burundi was French. So they had French nationals. The families went and said, "We have to find out what happened to this." So that is why France did an investigation. That investigation was led by a man named Bouguer, and it was he was a judge, an anti-terrorist judge, who had been involved in many different investigations of that nature. His conclusion was that the RPF had shot it down. His conclusion was very clear. They even indicted a certain number of people around Kagame, but not him, because he was a president or holding was in power. When Sarkozy won his election in 2007, the very first thing he did was try and restore good relations with the United States, which had been suffering since the French refusal to go to the war in Iraq. In other words, France, since the time of de Gaulle, had decided to have an independent foreign policy, independent of the United States. And that was held under Mitterrand, was the same thing under Chirac. When Sarkozy won, the first thing he did was go to the United States. He appointed as Foreign Affairs Minister Bernard Kouchner, who from the beginning had been pro-RPF. He'd been in the government of Mitterrand, but he was constantly pro-RPF. Bruguière then was no longer in charge of that investigation, so they named these two other people. And funnily enough, you have a change. They start doing an investigation where they say, well, maybe. It doesn't exonerate it, because what they did is, well, maybe that the missiles were shot from the Kanombe camp. The fact is that their proof on that is absolutely flimsy, and the people who were getting these two new judges who are now pursuing the original one, the original investigation, they had requested that the whole process be abandoned, and the court in France said no, we're going to continue this procedure. So like in Canada, in France, investigations like this are highly political, and if you see the current investigation, it is basically because the French decided they wanted to, they didn't want to have a fight with the United States any longer on this. To this point, you have to also take into consideration Paul Kagame's own close collaborators, his chief of staff, former military leader Nyamwasa, who's in South Africa, the head of security intelligence Karagea, who was assassinated on the 1st of January, and Teo Genudasingwa, who was his chief of staff and ambassador to Washington, have all said, and they've left the country, they were in the opposition, and they've been their lives are being threatened because they're saying they're opposed to what Kagame is doing. They've all said Kagame shot down the plane. Now, the final question is, so if we're about to say that it was Habyarimana's own camp that shot him down, which is absolutely illogical, and you know, I don't know any country and anywhere in the world where you can defend a position like that. Every time they tried to present that, they started presenting that at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and they abandoned it, that idea. They abandoned it because they had no proof. They had no witnesses. They couldn't even make a case for that. So they just abandoned that whole idea, because that was what they were saying. Yeah, these people shot down the plane, so then they could start have a reason to kill all the Tutsis. It's just hogwash. I mean, it doesn't. You know, you. First of all, there's no grounds for it. There's no for that. And second of all, it's contrary to reality that such a thing would happen.
At the you just mentioned the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda in 96 and 97, and the principal investigator, Michael Horrigan, had charged the crime to Kagame and the RPF. How did the tribunal respond to that?
Well, Michael Horrigan and his team, which of investigators, were given the responsibility of charging a number of different people and of investigating this very serious crime, which was within the mandate of the ICTR. They went about their work very professionally. They came up with testimony from people involved in the assassination that was very, very convincing. And they were told by Louise Arbour to do this investigation. When they came back and said, well, listen, we think it's the RPF, they reported that to Louise Arbour, who was, you know, the prosecutor, chief prosecutor of the ICTR. She was at first quite excited about it all. Then she went to The Hague, as I remember, and she then at a certain point she called, told Michael Hourigan to come to The Hague with her, to meet her, and said, stop all investigations, and basically said you had to get rid of all the information that they had collected so far. So the theory is that, in fact, she had gotten instructions from the person who had been responsible for her appointment there, which was Madeleine Albright. The United States basically had control of who was appointed to be a prosecutor. In fact, they had her name and had made contact with her without even speaking to the Canadian Ministry of Foreign Affairs when they appointed Louise Arbour. So Louise Arbour basically killed the investigation and gagged Michael Hourigan. Michael Hourigan left the ICTR shortly thereafter and basically had ruined his career. He passed away in December. And he has made an affidavit on this, which is available. His affidavit, he did it, I think, in 2007, where he made a sworn affidavit before an Australian court that this is what happened.
Okay. Well, so you're basically, the RPF, as you're saying, it's they're a very well-armed, and they, with U.S. and U.K. backing, were able to go in there and into through Rwanda, and the Hutus, you know, in over the course of trying to maintain and control the situation, they were very roundly condemned for the arrests of 8,000 people. But you're arguing that they were defending themselves. What is your take on the role of not just the Western governments, but like NGOs, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and a lot of the mainstream media in defending that narrative in the face of you know, the facts that you're outlining?
Well, I could see there was one particular human rights group or commission, fact-finding commission, which I deal with extensively, because in many ways they provided the moral high road to a band of killers backed by the United States and the UK. They provided information, totally biased information, about what was going on in Rwanda before 1990, between 1990 and 1994, and that report they made was used widely in order to further isolate and disempower the Rwandan government. When the RPF itself was occupying the country, had committed the supreme crime against international law, that is a crime against peace, when they made it a war, did a war of aggression, which is what it was. The human rights groups went in there and basically provided cover for the RPF. And there are many different cases. One of the cases was after the shooting down of the plane, when the Rwandan government tried to establish some form of organization and the functioning of the state, because the president and the chief of staff of the armed forces were shot down, including the president of Burundi. They sent their foreign minister to New York City to plead with the UN to send in troops and to obtain a ceasefire and to apply the accords. The human rights group, and it was Human Rights Watch, tried to prevent them. And in my book, I've got a description by Jérôme Bichimampaka, who is now in prison, but he's been totally acquitted, but they haven't found anywhere to send him. He's been acquitted of everything. And he describes exactly how that happened, when the human rights groups basically held sway before the UN rather than the legitimate representatives of the Rwandan government. And this is, in a sense, it heralded a new behavior, because they did this that same behavior, which taken to an even greater extent, was observed with Libya, when Libya wanted to have representation at the UN in 2011, but human rights groups were the ones who were sent there to represent them, because they didn't want the Gaddafi government to have a chance to represent itself.
Mm. Well, I was just wondering, finally, Robin, the extent to which the official narrative has prevailed, that this was essentially a Hutu catastrophe, and that now we need to intervene, with the responsibility to protect innocent civilians. Do you think that the power of that is related to sort of like a centuries old, well, racist attitudes towards Africa? Is there a...
Yeah, definitely. And the I chose as the title Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, and because I think the Rwanda has been the whole way that this story has been told about Rwanda, and the vocabulary, the language, the stories that people believe automatically reminds you of the original scramble for Africa, which was 1884, 1885, where basically in Europe at the Berlin Conference they divided up Africa. And what you have, just think about this story that they try and, Kaplan's one of them who does like this. They say that this population woke up one day and decided they wanted to kill their Tutsis. Those kind of things just don't happen. I'm sorry, they don't happen. If the great genocide of the 20th century, the terrible one, was the Nazis, but they left an entire paper trail of their intentions of doing it. They described it, and right through, and in other words, then they carried it out. In the case of what you have in Rwanda, is that you have a situation where you had originally had a revolution. They had a social revolution, and as one leading historian has said, Rwanda, with the exception of Zanzibar, is the only country in Black Africa where there was a revolution. In other words, you had a changing of the whole entire social order, a liberation of basically the people who were living as serfs under an aristocracy controlled by the Tutsis. And you had a complete change, a revolution. And so what happens is you have this situation where you have a minority-controlled army, highly armed and powerful, with powerful friends, invades. And everybody saw this as a counter-revolution, which it was. It was a counter-revolution you had going on there. And then the president is shot down, and this is after continual wearing down the population. And there were also 1.5 million refugees camped around Kigali, because they'd been pushed away from their land. You had a situation which was just waiting to explode. So there were people, neighbors killing neighbors, and people, and you had large numbers of infiltrated clandestine cells. The RPF, as I said, had 146 cells active and operating in Kigali alone. Now, these cells operate through friends, through family. You can just imagine that if people are fighting for their lives and their future, that there can be a lot of killing going on. And then the people who could have controlled that and put an end to that were with the Rwandan army. And but they were stuck fighting with this army, and the Americans at that point said, we're not going to carry out, we're not going to implement the agreements that we all signed a few months before, because we want this minority-dominated, powerful army to win completely. So it's so, you know, you have a situation where you can understand that that everything can just break loose, but of course, the official story is this imaginary that Africans just like to kill each other. And one of the things I did is I went through in my book and tried to examine it from the vocabulary and the literary conventions that were used by the authors of books who basically helped establish the official narrative. And they had a terribly similar ring to the literature which was written to justify colonialism between the 16th, 17th, 18th, colonialism and slavery from the 16th century on.
That's fascinating. Well, Robin Philpott, I think I have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for this very astounding analysis, and I guess I'll...
I hope it's helpful. One of the things we haven't talked about, but it's we could do that another time, is the Congo, because what we have, what has happened in the Congo, and you were talking about numbers of dead far in excess of what the official figures are about Rwanda, and that is the follow-up to what we've been describing. In other words, the invasion, the killing, and the displacement of people from 1990-1994, the climax in the 1994 where there was massive killing, and then the pursuit into the Congo and the occupation war, never-ending war that's been going on, and a lot of people have made a lot of money at the same time by the control of that part of Central Africa.
Okay. I agree. We should tackle that.
That's another subject.
Yeah, well, maybe I can call you in a couple of weeks and get into that. Yeah,
great.
We'll be okay.
And that marks the end of our show for this week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
And we've been speaking with Robin Philpott. He is a writer and translator and publisher based in Montreal. He's the author of the book Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. And you can get a copy of the book from the Global Research website. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click on the online store. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.